Well, good evening, everyone. Good to be here. Not sure it's so good being doing one and two Kings. It's a lot. But we'll see what we can do. And I hope that the questions I want to answer during the session are questions that arise from what I'm saying at that time, from that bit of Kings, or at least from Kings anyway, related things. I'm hoping that tonight we can see through the complications of the writing style and the fact that this is an ancient text and see God's hand in the history of this nation of Israel, Jesus' ancestors. And to tie together the thread of all the different books in the Bible that connect with this period of 1 and 2 Kings. I think it'd be easier, I'm hoping you're going to follow through in your Bibles, but it might be easier to follow by the section headings rather than trying to skim through and find out where I am. I'll give specific verses sometimes, but otherwise section headings may be easier. Okay, to begin at the beginning, we need to see that this is one book. It's been chopped in the middle to make two because of the length of scrolls at the time. And it continues the story of Israel after the books of Judges and Samuel, which David did last time. So it picks up from the end of David's reign with a stable, united kingdom and onto the fall of the northern kingdom of Samaria in 722 BC. And the destruction of Jerusalem 125 years later. That's 500 years in all, and we're going to do it in one go. That's a lot of history. It's a story in which the writer sees a clear moral. God is the Lord of history, actively involved in human affairs. When the nation and its leaders look to him and obey his laws, peace and prosperity follow. Political and economic disaster overtake Israel and Judah when they've been split as a direct consequence of the failure to follow God's covenant that he made with them. So, the context within a lot of the Old Testament. Chronicles covers a lot of the same period, but looks more at Judah than at Israel after the separation. We have Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, which are all attributed to Solomon, whose story appears in 1 Kings. We have the prophets, Elijah and Elisha, and then more prophets who actually have books in the Bible. Amos, Jonah, Hosea, Isaiah, Nahum, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, all in this period. Daniel and Ezekiel are partly in this period, but they prophesy more and have their stories more during the exile. Did I go the right way there? Right. We come at the beginning, where God has promised David a line that will last forever. But humanly speaking, that isn't possible. It can only happen because Jesus being the line of David. God has promised this to David, and yet we end up with the people exiled in Babylon. And it's during this time that 1 and 2 Kings was probably written by a prophet. And the purpose is to explain to the people of Israel how they got there and still to hold out hope for the future. 1 and 2 Kings I'll refer to it as Kings because that's what it really is, one book. It's not really a history book because there's so much that goes on, particularly in connection with the nations around them, that isn't in there. There are little references. But references are made to specific sources that were written much earlier than the Book of Kings. And he regularly refers to these things as sources. He says, is it not written in? And some of the books that he refers to are the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah and Israel, which is nothing to do with our Book of Chronicles in the Bible, Book of the Acts of Solomon, and the Book of Jashar, which we think was probably a songbook. There were also court archives, popular histories based on them. It's believed that there was a court history of David. So there were a lot of resources that he could access. Even stories of Elijah and Elisha, probably written by the group of prophets who were around at that time and interconnected with Elijah and Elisha. Let's start at the beginning, 1 Kings chapter 1. You'll note that where I should be is in the top left-hand corner of the PowerPoint. David is old. He's losing his grip. His eldest surviving son, Adonijah, decides he wants to be king. The throne has been promised to Solomon, but Adonijah thinks it's his right. He gets the support of the army commander Joab and one of the high priests, Shimei. Those who are close to David tip him off, and David outmaneuvers him and makes a formal declaration that Solomon is king and he is anointed before David has died. Chapter 2. On his deathbed, David tells Solomon to walk in God's ways. A recurring theme to the kings. Follow the covenant. Do what you know is right. But he also tells him to deal with the troublemakers, Joab and Shimei, who have been up to some bad things previously as well. David has been merciful, but he knows that Solomon has to deal with them. Verse 14 onwards, whether Adonijah is deliberate or foolish, he makes a request that leads to his death. He wants to marry one of David's harem, which would give him a claim to the throne. Solomon is not merciful this time. He dies. The army commander decides that his time must be up, so he gets a chop. Shimei is put under a house arrest, but it's Jerusalem he shouldn't leave. After 3 years, he thinks it's all okay. He leaves, so he pays the price. We now get to the chapter where Solomon receives the gift of wisdom. I think Solomon was actually pretty wise already. We've seen how he dealt with people already. But the first three verses are very interesting on what they tell us. Verse 1, Solomon marries an Egyptian princess. He creates a stable kingdom not by force, but by clever alliances. Egypt was often trying to annex Canaan. It was its major trade route to the north. And it was always looking for opportunities to take over Israel. An alliance through marriage is the next best thing. Verse 2, Israelite worship was happening in the same places as Canaanite worship, on hilltops. That wasn't a Yahweh thing. That was an idolatry thing. And yet the tabernacle was on one of these hilltops where idolatry happened as well. And Solomon worships God in one of these places. I've used the word syncretism here because it's a useful word which basically means mixing up two religions, moral philosophies, so that neither is a pure form. They're adulterated. And this happens through these 500 years. It was a bad example, really, that Solomon gave that foreshadows future issues. Verses 4 to 28 are the story of God promising Solomon wisdom and fame and fortune. We should know that story fairly well, so I won't go into it. It's followed by the example of the story of two prostitutes and a baby. We should know that story fairly well as well. And it's an example of Solomon's wisdom, because he knows that the true mother would never let any harm come to the baby. This shows us that the king had ordinary people had access to the king. The king judged the people. And as an aside, they were prostitutes, but they were probably Canaanite inhabitants rather than Jews. Chapter 4. Lots of names and places, which we won't go into. Solomon organizes the kingdom. He's a great organizer. And this is part of the reason for the wealth. He knows how to handle people and places. The trouble is, he's divided the kingdom into 12, but it's not on the same lines as the tribes, which doesn't really help things for the future. But the land that is covered by Israel, as it is at this time, is all the land promised to Abraham. It goes as far north as Damascus. Chapters 5 to 7 deal with the construction of the temple that David wanted to build, but Solomon does it instead. Much of the design reflects pagan temples of the time, because it was built mostly by pagans, because they knew how to build temples. But there are key differences, obviously, for a temple that is for Yahweh. Although the temple isn't very big, the craftsmanship and the sheer scale of it are quite staggering when you actually read through it and see what was involved. Everything, absolutely every surface, virtually covered in gold. This came at an immense cost. I don't think Solomon suffered because of the cost, but the people did. If you note in chapter 5, verse 13, he conscripts Israelite labor. It's virtual slavery from 1 month in three for tens of thousands of people. In here we have his trade with Hiram, king of Tyre. It was another one of Solomon's deals which kept the peace, and he was very generous in what he paid. We note in chapter 7 that he builds a temple, a palace for himself, which is the same system, the same conscription, the same taxation. But he does prioritize the temple. Chapter 8, the ark is brought into the temple and it's dedicated. Interestingly, in verse 8, there's a mention that you can see the poles of the Ark of the Covenant through the door, and it says it's still there today. Well, obviously, it wasn't when this was written in the exile, so it shows again how the writer is quoting previous texts. God's presence appears as a cloud in the temple, just as it did in the desert at the time of Exodus. It's interesting reading Solomon's praise of God and his dedication. He asked God to bless the temple and that it would be a focus for the prayers, not just of Israelites, but of all people and all nations. Because we see even here, God is a God of all the nations. Everything seems good at this point. Success, wealth, wisdom, and God in the temple. God, again, gives the promise of the line of David to Solomon, conditionally on obedience to God's laws. Verse 10 to 28, we see much more of what Solomon gets up to during his reign. He's built the temple and palace at a tremendous cost. He's even given away towns of Israelites to another nation in the north. Building projects galore. Forts, fortifications, storage for the farm produce. And he even builds a navy for the first time, because He wants to trade and bring back precious jewels, etc., from other lands. Verse 22 points out that although Solomon did use this forced labor from the Israelites, most of the workforce were conquered Canaanites, who basically are enslaved for generations. That's how it was in those days. Chapter 10, the Queen of Sheba. Sheba is considered to be more like the Yemen area. She is very wealthy herself, and she recognizes that God has blessed Solomon. And she brings great riches, but we see later in the chapter it's not just gifts. There is trade again going on here. We read of the incredible ostentatious wealth of Solomon, the things that he makes out of gold just for the fun of it. It comes through trade, gifts from foreign admirers, and taxes. The people are actually taxed heavily. I do wonder how much of the prosperity actually trickled down to the ordinary people. Beginning of chapter 11, we don't tend to think of Solomon as being the downfall of Israel, but he is. It's where the rot really starts. As he gets older, things go downhill. He has a weakness for women, hundreds of women. He marries princesses from all sorts of nations. And of course, he easily got them because he would be a very attractive prospect for other nations because of his wealth. They would get a part of it if they were connected by marriage, even if they were only one of 700. But these women have their idols. They come with baggage of idol worship. And some of these are from nations where God forbade the Israelites to marry. He not only allows them to keep their gods, but he even builds altars and shrines for them to worship at, and towards the end joins them in their idolatrous worship. He breaks the covenant spectacularly. And God tells him that the warnings of breaking the covenant will come to pass. He is the king that Samuel warned the people against when he anointed Saul. We find that despite all that had gone before and the glowing words that you read about this period of Solomon, it's not been perfect. Israel has always had enemies, and Solomon creates his own enemies, as every king does in this time. He's managed to control them. But a prophet called Ahijah is told by God to anoint Jeroboam, a young man in Solomon's court, and tell him that he will be taking over the 10 northern tribes. Solomon finds out, and Jeroboam has to run. He runs to Egypt. Egypt is always looking for a way to get around Israel. As I said before, it's their major trade route. They want to control the Israelite lands. So to harbor an enemy is good for them. Chapter 12. Solomon has died. His son Rehoboam takes the throne. This guy Jeroboam comes back and he represents the 10 tribes and says, "We're happy to serve you. Just lift the taxes a little. Don't demand so much from the people." And Rehoboam, of course, says, "No, I'll make it worse." So the kingdoms divide. 10 tribes to the north, and Rehoboam is left just with Judah and Benjamin. Now, what held the 12 tribes together wasn't having the same king. It was being Jews, being Israelites. It was the worship of Yahweh, the temple at Jerusalem, the feasts, the national memories. Jeroboam realizes this, but instead of saying, yes, we are this people, he thinks, I don't want our 10 tribes going down to Jerusalem to worship. That will break us up. I know what, I'll make our own shrines, our own places of worship. And he sets up a golden calf at Dan in the north, Bethel in the south, and tells the people to worship there. And he sets up festivals that compete with the normal Israelite festivals and bases them around these two calves. The story in Kings moves from south to north to south to north. It jumps around. And you have to be careful, especially with some of the similar names, as to where you are. So hopefully we will see the difference as we move on and be able to keep a clear idea of what's happening. The two kingdoms are now weak, and they're nearly always fighting with each other. Makes them prey to the surrounding powers. The question is, the writer of Kings says, who will follow God? Will these kings lead the people in the ways of Yahweh? When we go through the list of kings, what we might call the bad kings, get very few words, most of them. And so they get skipped past, even when it's 30, 40 years. Because the writer isn't interested in them. They weren't good. This is a plan, a map of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. It's a bit complicated, but the idea is just to give you an idea of, as we move through and talk about these different kingdoms around them, where on earth are they? At very top right, you'll see, is the Assyrian Empire, which comes into the story later. Aram Damascus, you could also call Syria, and the Arameans are what they're normally referred to in Kings. We have the Phoenician states, Tyre, Sidon, where a lot of the timber and valuables came from for the temple. And that's a great trading place. They had a great navy. And that's also where Jezebel comes from, when we get to Ahab and Jezebel. We have the Ammonites to the east, the Moabites to the southeast, Edomites to the south, and the kind of Arabu tribes, and further south than that, that's Egypt, basically. So that's where we're at, and we need to keep that in our minds as we go through and see who's who and what happens. We now enter a time in the book of Kings where God speaks prominently through the prophets. They were there before, but now Kings gives them a voice. Some are based in Israel in the north, Elijah, Elisha. Some in Judah in the south, like Isaiah. Chapter 13 begins with a prophecy against those altars of Jeroboam. He takes no notice and pays the consequences, because a prophet tells Jeroboam's wife that because of his idolatry, his son will die and his family will be destroyed. Verse 21, chapter 14, we move back to Judah and Rehoboam. They do no better than Israel. They start erecting idols and shrines, prostitution, and pay the price. Egypt seizes its opportunity and attacks. They reach Jerusalem and ransack the temple and the palace. 5 years after Solomon dies, all that gold, all that wealth is stripped. They lose it all. They have gone for idolatry, worshipping other gods, and paid the price. So Rehoboam has lost all of that. He's succeeded by his son Abijah, who's as bad as his father. We hear nothing about him, really. Abijah is succeeded by his son Asa, He gets rid of the shrines and the Asherah poles. These are, we don't know exactly what they are, but basically they were part of idol worship. In the north, after Jeroboam, it's a mess. Israel's usually in a mess. His son becomes king, but after 2 years, there's a coup. A new king called Baasha kills all of Jeroboam's family, so that prophecy is fulfilled. Chapter 16, we see that Baasha's son Elah becomes king. Only 2 years, there's another coup. And that family is murdered by a guy called Zimri. He lasts 7 days before there's a civil war. And a guy called Omri, who was the army commander, wins, makes himself king. And he builds the capital city for Israel called Samaria. He's another evil king. 16 verse 29, a well-known character enters the stage, Ahab. He's a son of Omri, and he's the worst of all the kings so far. He marries this lady called Jezebel from Sidon up in northwest, and he supports her worship of Baal. He positively encourages it. We have this syncretism going on. It sounds like God is forgotten, but he isn't. It carries on at the same time. The foreign gods get introduced, but worship at the temple carries on in a kind of a distorted way, often with idols being put in the temple and worshipped at the same time. You get the strange mixes. There are still people who worship God in the pure form, in its natural form, and then you get a lot of people who also worship the idols as well, just in case. Chapter 17, Elijah comes onto the national stage. A solitary figure, but there are a lot of other prophets unmentioned at the time. Quite often there are prophets mentioned with no name. They just appear and disappear. But we hear a lot about Elijah. He tells Ahab that because of his idolatry, there'll be no rain. Baal was a god of rain and fertility for agriculture. Ahab and Jezebel are not pleased with him. He has to run and hide. There is a drought. And this is where we come to the story of Elijah being fed by ravens, getting water from a brook, but that water dries up, and he goes to a place called Zarephath, which is in Sidon, where Jezebel comes from. But she doesn't find him. And we have the story of the widow with the jar of oil, which doesn't run out, the jar of flour, which doesn't run out until the rains come. And Elijah also raises her son from the dead when he falls ill. Chapter 18, the prophet Obadiah makes a very brief appearance, but only as a messenger between Ahab and Elijah. And we have the assembly on Mount Carmel. 850 prophets, because it actually says it's not just Baal, it's prophets of Asherah as well. Another one of these idols. Elijah gives the choice, is it God or is it Baal? Everything is in favor of Baal. But we know what happens. God is the one who lights the sacrifice, and God shows his sovereignty, and he even brings the rain as well. This does not please Jezebel. Instead of learning from it, she just gets angry, and poor Elijah has to run again. He has to run miles and miles. He has to go right to the south. Horeb, I think, is probably Sinai, Mount Sinai. And he's exhausted, depressed. And God shows him that despite everything that's gone on, God is in control. He still has power, not just in the wind, in the earthquake, in the fire. God just needs a still small voice to show his power. Elijah feels alone. But God says there are 7,000 people who are godly still in Israel. So Elijah has to shake off the past, go and do some anointing, and take Elisha as a successor. I think it's interesting, isn't it, how bad things were at this point where there are only 7,000 true believers, and this is meant to be God's people. Isn't this an indication to us that when things seem really bad, when the church seems to be on the back foot and shrinking, doesn't mean God isn't there, doesn't mean he's not in control. He knows what's happening, and he has a plan. Out of interest, Elijah means the Lord is God. Elisha means God saves. Chapters 20 and 21. Chapter 20 covers a period when there's war with Aram. Remember, these are the people to the north, Syria. They attack and beat Ahab. But this is the syncretism going on. Ahab is still listening to God's prophets. He knows that they know things. He knows that God can make a difference. He beats the king of Aram because that king is dismissive of Yahweh, and God doesn't like that. But he then fails to consult the prophets when it comes to dealing with his victory, and God pronounces a judgment on Ahab and the people of Israel. In chapter 21, we get this example of the evil of Jezebel and Ahab, where Ahab wants this guy's vineyard. The king has no right to take property under the law at that time in Israel. So Jezebel organizes him to be killed in a pretend trial. So Elijah prophesies judgment on Ahab and Jezebel. Dogs will lick up his blood, and dogs will eat Jezebel's body. Although Ahab is still described as vile at this point, he mourns and fasts, and God stays the judgment until his son is king. Move south again. We're in Judah. Jehoshaphat becomes king of Judah when Ahab has been on his throne for 2 years. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but the idol worship still carried on. We have a long chapter about Ahab asking for Jehoshaphat's help to fight a king of Aram again. In summary, Ahab's prophets tell him he'll win. Jehoshaphat says, I'd like one of the Lord's prophets to see what he has to say. Micaiah the prophet says, you'll lose. So Ahab says, stick him in jail and we'll go and fight them anyway. So they lose. Ahab is killed and dogs lick up the blood from the wounds that he had. He is succeeded by his son Ahaziah, and Jehoshaphat in the south hands over to his son Jehoram. Two kings at last. Chapter 1. King Ahaziah of Israel is as bad as his father. He gets injured and consults with the prophets of Baal about whether he will live. God tells Elijah to go and tell him, you're going to die because you ignored me. You asked the wrong gods. His son Joram takes over. Chapter 2. We have the story of Elijah passing on his role to Elisha. I just want to say about this double portion of the Spirit. At that time, in inheritance, if you had 4 children, your inheritance would be divided into 5, and the eldest son would get a double portion, and the others would get 1 each, because the eldest son took responsibility for the family. So that's what Elisha means when he asks for a double portion. Another thing I want to just pick up on is a chariot of fire appears And Elijah goes up to heaven. He doesn't go up to heaven in the chariot of fire. He goes up in the whirlwind. Chapter 3. New king of Israel, Joram, gets rid of Baal, but he still carries on the distorted worship of the golden calves. So he was still described as evil. We're now into several chapters on events that mostly happened during Joram's reign, but the stories are about Elisha, and they're mostly about miracles that happened through Elisha. Whereas Elijah prophesied and did miracles with kings, Elisha is much more a people person. He's often with the other prophets. His first miracle was in chapter 2, where he purifies a bad water supply. The next one is when Jehoshaphat and Joram band together. Again, you've got the north and south actually working together against a common enemy, Moabites on the east. Elisha prophesies for him, and the army is provided for because they were in a bad place. The Moabites are tricked, and they lose the battle really badly. The third one is a destitute widow who gets a constant replenishing of oil so she can sell the oil to pay off her debts. The fourth one, Elisha prophesies for a childless woman. She gives birth a year later, but a few years after that, the boy dies. But Elisha, with a bit of trouble, it has to be said, brings him back to life. Then next one, in a time of famine, Elisha makes safe a meal that was made with poisonous gourds. Good job he did, because he was going to be one of the people who ate it. Sixth one, 20 bread rolls feed 100 men, and we can assume their families as well. Quite a lot of these miracles are ghosts of what Jesus does, if you notice. Seventh one is this odd one where Naaman, who's the commander of the Aramean army, if you remember, the Arameans keep attacking, keep causing problems, and yet Elisha heals him. He tells him to wash 7 times in the Jordan to begin with. Naaman says, "I'm not doing that." But he's persuaded to comply. His leprosy goes. You wonder why, don't you? He was an enemy of Israel, and yet God healed him. But he commits himself to God. And the interesting thing is, he asks for forgiveness in advance because he knows he will have to worship with his king, worship idols, which he knows is wrong, but he wouldn't be able to get out of it. And Elisha says, yeah, God says that's okay. He forgives you for doing that. Next one, in chapter 6, an iron axe head is lost in the river. Elisha makes it float. This is the beginning of the Iron Age. This is almost like gold, especially as the prophet who was using it had only borrowed it, and they were making a village for the prophets to live in. Next one is in verse 8. Again, the Arameans are raiding deep into Israel. They keep trying to trap Joram's army, but Elisha keeps telling the king where they are and protects him. The king of the Arameans is frustrated, and he says, right, we're going to go and get Elisha. But as they come to the city, Elisha prays that they'll be blinded. And it says that Elisha actually guides them to... where am I? Samaria. To Samaria. Thank you, David. I was almost forgetting whether I was in north or south there again. And he tells Joram, don't kill them, feed them well. And they went back, and the raids that had been happening stopped. Maybe not for that long, though, because the next miracle is when they attack again and the city of Samaria is under siege. There's really bad famine. It's quite a long story in there about how bad it was. King Joram actually blames God and tries to kill Elisha, as if that would help. But Elisha tells the king, tomorrow there will be food. It will be cheap. He can't believe it. But that night, the Arameans hear what they think is reinforcements for the Israelites. They think it's the Egyptians coming, and they run. And they leave everything behind. And indeed, everything is cheap because it's plentiful, because there's a whole army's worth of supplies for the city. Chapters 8, 9, 10, we move back to the intrigue and mayhem of the various kings. Elisha carries out God's instructions that were given to Elijah to anoint successors to each kingdom, because they've only now come onto the world stage. A guy called Jehu, different to the one before, takes over Israel. He kills King Joram and he kills all of Ahab's family. That prophecy is fulfilled. And he has Jezebel thrown out of a window and she dies. They can't be bothered to do anything with the body, and when they come back to find it, dogs have eaten the whole body. Only her head and hands are left. Jehu pretends that he's a great Baal worshipper, and he gets the prophets of Baal and the supporters all to come to, I think he brings them to the temple. But it's a ruse, and he has them all killed. And I like it where it says, the people have used the temple of Baal for a latrine to this day. But he still allowed the worship at Dan and Bethel, this kind of national symbol. Back in Judah, we have the rise of an evil queen, Athaliah. She's a daughter of Ahab, and she takes control. She kills all of David's descendants, as far as she knows. But a baby is hidden. Joash is hidden in the temple and kept safe by the chief priest. She reigns for 6 years and encourages Baal worship in Judah. When he thinks it's right, and the baby is still a young boy, the high priest feels he has enough support and he anoints him king, which really pleases the people. Athaliah was obviously not a popular person. She's killed. And the high priest makes a covenant between God, Joash, and the people that they would be the Lord's people. Joash reigns 40 years. He repairs the temple. He does lots of good things, but he doesn't remove those high places where sacrifices and incense were still burnt. Aram comes again. The only way he can put them off is by giving them the temple gold and precious objects. And he gets assassinated by his officials. Something that I thought was rather interesting was the temple seems to have lots of gold and then it doesn't. It has gold, then it hasn't. And obviously what happens is when they recover from the last attack and being subjugated by somebody else, they then remake the temple ornaments. They remake the gold things. Chapter 13. This is a time when Aram, Syria, is in dominance. It's always been a problem. Now it's the greater power. They control most of Israel and Judah. And we have this arrangement where the vanquished have to give up money, pay tribute continually. We have another evil king in Israel, Jehoash, and during his reign, Elisha dies aged about 80 after a time of illness. Again, we can see this syncretism. This evil king recognizes that Elisha is worth more to Israel than all the army and chariots that he has, and he cries over his death. Chapter 14, back in Judah, Amaziah is king, and he did right in the eyes of the Lord, but the high places are still left. He did well in fighting the nations around him. Judah prospered. But stupidly, he picked a fight with Israel again and lost to Jehoash. Move on. Jeroboam II becomes king of Israel. He's pretty bad, like the previous ones. But the king says that God had compassion on the people. He felt they'd had enough from these kings. And so the king is successful in restoring the land and the wealth of Israel. He even gets as far as Damascus, the Aramean country, and brings prosperity. It's during his reign that Amos and Hosea are prophesying against the extremes of wealth and poverty and exploitation of the weak. And it's notable that in verse 25 of chapter 14, there's a prophecy of Jonah referenced. Chapter 15, in Judah we have Azariah, also known as Uzziah, as king for 52 years. Like his father, he's a good king, but the high places are not removed. Later in life, he suffers from leprosy. In Chronicles, it tells us that this was a punishment from God for something he did. And so for much of his reign, his son Jotham acts in his place. Isaiah, if we remember our study on Isaiah, we should know. Back in Israel, we have a series of short-lived kings, more assassinations, wanton bloodshed. Assyria becomes the big power, and Israel is a puppet. After 10 years, two more evil kings come and go in quick succession. Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, invades again. He takes control of large parts of Israel and deports a lot of the Israelites all over Assyria. Not quite the end of Israel, but it's not good. Back south in Judah, this godly king Jotham takes over from King Uzziah. Isaiah, is now on the scene. But King Uzziah is replaced by King Ahaz, who is vile, unlike his father and grandfather. He's one of the kings who actually sacrifices his own son to Baal. Aram and Israel attack Judah, and Ahaz calls on Assyria for help. And he has to ransack the temple to pay for it. And he then proceeds to dismantle and rearrange parts of the temple so that it's not the temple it was. Back in Israel, chapter 15, Hoshea took the throne by assassination. As we said, he's a vassal to Assyria. But he stops paying tribute and decides that Egypt will help him. But Assyria invades, besieges Samaria for 3 years, which tells you something about how horrendous it must have been there. The people and their king are captured and transported all over the Assyrian Empire. It's the end of Israel. Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, repopulates the land with other conquered peoples. So you have a real mix. Their various religions come with them, and it gets mixed up again with the traditional worship of Yahweh. And this results in the mixed up religion of the Samaritans in Jesus' time. The rest of the chapter is all about the fact that this happened to Israel because they didn't follow God. We now have just Judah, but we have Hezekiah as king. He's the best so far. He even removes the high places and destroys, you know, the bronze snake that Moses had made? That had become an object of idol worship instead of being what it was. So he has that destroyed. The Assyrians are now looking at Judah. We can have references towards this in Isaiah and in Micah as well. Isaiah 36, Micah chapter 1 refer to this time. This is when the army commanders use their scare tactics and talk to the people. They challenge Hezekiah, but they boast that God can't save Judah because he didn't save any of the other nations, and the Assyrians are always the victors. Hezekiah consults with Isaiah, and the Assyrians withdraw because they think they have to fight another battle on another front. It doesn't last for long. They're back again with King Sennacherib, and they lay siege to Jerusalem. Hezekiah prays again. And Isaiah receives a major prophecy about the destruction of Sennacherib. This is the story where the Assyrian army are struck with a plague. Thousands, tens of thousands of them die, and they have to return to Nineveh empty-handed. Hezekiah falls ill, but he really prays to God. And God says, okay, you can have 15 more years. And I'll deliver you from Assyria. They're delivered from Assyria because Babylon is the rising power. It makes overtures to Hezekiah, who stupidly shows them all the wealth that they have in Jerusalem. As a result, Isaiah prophesies the fall of Judah to Babylon. King Hezekiah dies, Manasseh succeeds him, he's bad, he reinstates all the Baal worship, puts altars to worship the stars in the temple, he practices sorcery and is another one who sacrifices one of his own children to Baal. The prophets speak of the awful destruction of Jerusalem and all Judah. After him, Amon comes to the throne. He's evil. He gets assassinated. The people don't like the fact that one of David's line has been assassinated, so they kill the plotters, and his son Josiah is made king. Josiah was only 8. But again, I think we see the high priests being involved in bringing him up. He followed Yahweh. He seems to be the best of all the kings. He had the temple renovated, and they found the book of the law, which is Deuteronomy, we think. Josiah realizes how bad his predecessors had been. He understands what the covenant is. He consults a prophetess of God who tells him of the coming destruction of Judah. But he is told that because of his humility before God, he will die in peace before it happens. Chapter 23, we are getting near the end. Josiah then systematically does a thorough job of destroying and desecrating all the places of idol worship. Even the golden calf at Bethel, he goes and destroys. Thank you. When you see the list of what he destroys, it shows how bad things had got. The amount of things that he had to get rid of is quite amazing. Child sacrifice happened widely. We often don't understand how bad it was. Josiah makes a silly mistake. An Egyptian army is passing, and he decides that they are of evil intent and attacks them and loses, and he's killed. This encounter with Egypt puts them under Egypt's thumb. Josiah's elder son is imprisoned in Egypt. His brother Jehoiakim was installed on the basis that he paid tribute to Egypt. The king and the people revert to idolatry again, despite all that Josiah had done. Chapter 24. The end of Judah is messy. Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar defeats Egypt. That means it controls Judah now. But King Jehoiakim, the next one, rebels. So he's attacked by Babylonian-supported forces from the east. He has to surrender Jerusalem, and all the leadership are exiled with 7,000 fighting men and 1,000 craftsmen. I haven't checked on this, but it seems to me this is probably when Daniel and his friends are taken to Babylon. This is the end. For 9 years, they kind of struggle on. Zedekiah then rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, who lays siege to Jerusalem. The starvation forces the king and his army to break out of the city, but they're caught, mostly killed. A month later, the Babylonians come and they destroy, ransack the temple, palace, and every important building. They exiled the rest of the inhabitants that were of any means. The poorest they left to work the land. High-ranking priests, advisors, and commanders were executed. The book of Kings ends rather oddly with this story in verse 27. King Jehoiakim, who we did mention earlier, he's a descendant of King David. He is released from prison after 37 years, and the new reigning king in Babylon decides to give him a seat of honor and an allowance for the rest of his life. He is in favor with the king of Babylon. And here ends 1 and 2 Kings. Sorry it took so long.